everyone, Data Stories number 8, and I'm here, Enrico, together with Moritz. Hi Moritz, how are you?
Hola, doing well, thanks.
And we have a super special guest today. We have Jeff Hare with us. Hi Jeff.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Okay, great. So I don't know if I really have to introduce you. So Jeff Hare is a professor at Stanford currently, and I think he's very well known on the, let's say, on the web and the blogosphere for being the inventor of several information visualization toolkits, starting from Prefuse, then to Flare, and then to, what's next, Protovis, and finally D3 with Mike Bostock, right, Jeff?
That's right. So Protovis and D3 were work that I was lucky enough to get to pursue with Mike Bostock, okay, who is my PhD student here at Stanford.
Okay. How is it going? What are you doing? Can you tell us what are you currently doing? How is this whole thing about visualization developing in your group? And what's next?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, a lot of the work we've done in the past, which is focused on a variety of things, you know, visualization tools, as you mentioned, but also, you know, studies of human perception and also visualization techniques. For example, I've been interested in animation in the past. I can say we're still interested in all of those things, but I'd say one of the wonderful things about being a professor is that you get to work with a team of students. And so this is allowing us to kind of branch out and explore even more areas. And one theme that I've been particularly interested in is not looking just at visualization, which typically concerns itself with, you know, taking data, finding ways to express that visually that are effective, where effective means people can solve problems faster, communicate stories well, all of that. Still very important, but I've been trying to understand the role of visualization more largely in the life cycle of data analysis. So for any of us who work with data, we know that it's a really, you know, iterative, often tumultuous process where, you know, we have to deal with issues of, well, how do we find data? How do we assess the quality of that data? How do we shape it to meet our needs? How do we use visualization as well as statistics and other tools to gain insights? And then, of course, how do we share what we learn, whether it's through creating images or telling stories, et cetera? This entire process is very interesting and involves combining lots of different activities. So certainly things with from databases, from machine learning, as well as visualization. And I'm really interested, and my research group as a whole is interested in figuring out, well, what's the role of visualization interaction techniques throughout that process?
Yeah.
How can we make people more effective and go about that process in ways that are more successful?
Yeah, great. I remember I think it was a few weeks ago, I saw this presentation from you in Constance when you came, and I was surprised by the title you gave to your presentation, which, if I remember well, was Interacting with Data. And I was really interested by this idea of putting the accent on the interaction part more than on the visual part. Is that on purpose?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on purpose. I think the main goal with that is to contrast maybe an old-fashioned notion of data analysis as sort of dry number crunching, to really realize that the activity of data analysis, not just any one step like computing a correlation, but really working with data and engaging analysis, is highly interactive. And so it really wasn't in any attempt to kind of obscure visualization as an important component there, but really to kind of put the onus on this highly iterative, highly interactive process in which, you know, importantly, I think visualization plays a critical role throughout all of these tasks. And I think what's very interesting is to think about some of the ways that we can use visualization that are really valuable, but maybe aren't always the ways we think about it. So, for example, you know, many of us are interested in visualization as an end product, but I have many colleagues, you know, whether they're in statistics or machine learning, natural language processing, you know, at the end of the day, like, their goal might be to create an interesting model or algorithm. But even for that end goal, visualization can be incredibly helpful for, you know, assessing results, making sense of data quality, seeing if your models even make sense. You know, all of these tasks, I think, are really interested and also interactive in their own right. And so it was kind of understand that process that led me to really think about this as, you know, with interaction as one of the key phrases.
Yeah. I think this is really interesting. And actually, it reminds me of something I always have in the back of my mind, that I think visualization is very, so the way it is presented on the web is pretty much centered around using visualization as a communication tool. But in academia, we have such a larger focus on using visualization as an exploratory tool, right? And of course, this is a very broad generalization. It's not always true. But yeah, when you mention people like, I don't know, machine learning specialists who might use visualization to better understand the model and not necessarily using visualization to present their results to somebody else, I think it's really interesting. And but maybe there's not a lot of exposure of this kind of use of visualization, right?
Yeah, I think there's... And one, there's a lack of exposure just because I think on the web, some of the more storytelling or artistically oriented visualizations is just, they appeal to a much larger audience. So it's not surprising that that would be more familiar. But I think also there's, for folks who maybe are primarily doing machine learning modeling or something like that, they're not going to, you know, they have things that work to get done. They don't have the time to design new visualizations from scratch and implement them. And so the lack of good tools can also be an impediment to be people to be able to pick up and use visualization for tasks where ideally the visualization should let you get it done really quick. So if you're losing hours or days to just get that visualization, it's defeated the whole purpose.
Yeah.
I think having good tools that really fit the task is a key component and really making visualization effective for throughout this data lifecycle.
Yeah. I also really always appreciate your sort of wholesome approach there. You also, I think, brought up in the academic world this whole topic of data wrangling and dealing with the dirtiness of data, right? Because often in academia or in visualization, to me, it seems that people assume there is this perfect data set already out there and you're just concerned with mapping it, but that there's a whole process of acquiring the right data, transforming your data, merging it with other data sets, that a lot of the practical time is actually spent on that is... I liked how you acknowledged that and tried to provide a good tools for that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, this observation really just came from pain and personal suffering that I think anyone who works with data can hopefully readily attest to. Yeah. Which is, I mean, you look at all the these beautiful projects that people have done, or these really interesting research papers people have published in the area of visualization, and there's often some very nice results, but. I've talked to people at conferences and found out, 60%, 80% of their time was actually spent on manipulating that data to get it into the place where then it's right for visualization. And so I'm like, well, this is sort of an elephant in the room, and maybe we should address it. And more importantly, maybe there's some really interesting projects that we'll be able to do that both advance research, because obviously I'm a professor, so that's something I care deeply about, but also, at the end of the day, create tools that allow people to get their job done more effectively. And... just as an aside, one of the things that's been really fun in this project for me is that, this is not a new problem. Obviously, folks in databases and statistics have worried about this problem for many, many years. And so they've developed lots of methods. But I think at the end of the day, what's been missing is a more complete approach from the perspective of interaction and visualization to make all these different tools available to folks in a way that they can apply. Because a push-button solution where you're going to have, some smart algorithm figure it all out for you just really isn't very reasonable at this point in time. It really requires human judgment to say, okay, is this strange value an error, or is this the finding of a lifetime? And so having good interactive systems that allow people to transform data, find problems within data, and then manipulate it in ways that allow them to move on with their analysis, whether that's fitting models or building visualizations, I think is a problem that's shared by very many people these days.
Let me just briefly mention for those who are listening to the podcast and don't know that there is this very nice tool that you developed in your group that is called Wrangler, that is an interactive visual support for manipulating data. And I think we will add the link to our blog post later.
Yeah.
And maybe we want to move on to, I'm sure, so before starting this new episode, a few weeks ago, when we originally wanted to do the interview, I posted on Twitter I said, if you want to send some questions to Jeff Hare, please send some to us. And I received a lot of questions. I'm not sure whether we will be able to cover all of them. No, for sure we won't be able to cover all of them. But we definitely got a lot of questions about Prefuse, Flare, Protovis, D3. And I think the first question that many people have, including myself, is, can you briefly tell us what's the story behind so many making so many different toolkits? How did you go from Prefuse to Flare, Protovis, and D3? It would be nice to know at least the story behind that. I'm sure you have a nice story.
Oh, sure. So, yeah, it's really a story with two main chapters. And the first chapter was while I was a graduate student at Berkeley. And actually, even prior to that, I had been working with folks at Xerox PARC. And, you know, over time, as many of us do, kind of building up a set of routines for visualizations. And over time, I began to try and organize it into a library. And when it was in a shape that was kind of, it was ready for its initial commit into Subversion for the code sharing repository. And I was listening to music at the time. I was in the office with friends, and we were listening to the artist Prefuse 73, who's an electronic musician on Warp Records. And so me and my friend Alan Neuberger looked at each other and we said, well, I guess you are what you eat. So we just named the repository Prefuse because that's what we were listening to. And then with the idea that we might change the name later when we come up with something.
And you never did.
And we never did. And so we wrote a paper on it a number of years ago where we kind of gave some ad, you know, post hoc, you know, rationale for why Prefuse was a good name for a visualization tool. But that it was all made up.
Can I ask you something? Did you start your thesis already thinking about creating a toolkit, or this was just...
Not at all. No, this was definitely, I was building visualizations and I was seeing recurring patterns. Okay. And so I was then just trying to make it easier to create visualizations. Yeah. And then as it evolved and became more and more useful, you know, I started to wonder, well, would this be useful? You know, does this make a research contribution? And in fact, many people told me it wasn't. and they're like, oh, that's just engineering. You know, that's just coding. Mm-hmm. You know, like, where's the big idea? And you know, I think those are useful challenges to have because it's important to be reflective about what you do and what are the bigger lessons that you learned. And so I was very lucky to be able to work at Xerox PARC for a while, including, you know, my managers included folks like Ed Chi and Stu Card. And they had thought a lot about this as well. And so just understanding at a higher level how the abstractions being put in place within the toolkit, you know, actually corresponded to some other theories of the visualization process and how it was really instantiating those. So then arguing from there something about how you can conceive of the completeness of the toolkit, et cetera. And so then it obviously ended up being somewhat successful. And so that was actually, I think it's still my most cited research paper. So for any students out there listening, when people tell you that what you're doing isn't research, you should listen carefully and then figure out how to intelligently prove them wrong.
Yeah, and that's still, I think, the only real major Java visualization framework out there, right? I mean...
There's a number of Java frameworks out there, but I think they tend to focus on maybe more tightly scoped parts. Yeah, I know there's like charting libraries, mm-hmm. and there's libraries for graph visualization.
Networks, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And they all have some really wonderful strengths. And mm-hmm. so again, I'm not dogmatic when it comes to choice of tool. I mean, use what's right for the job.
Sure.
I don't think one tool fits them all. So I developed Prefuse for a number of years, and one of the things that was really interesting with that was interacting with the user community. And so if for any Prefuse users out there, they probably, you know, may remember, if depending on when they started using it, a huge difference between the alpha version and the beta version. I basically rewrote the entire thing. Mm-hmm. And that was really in response to that, you know, being written in Java. Turns out the primary user base was enterprise software developers in Java, and so it really kind of evolved to fit their needs and that way of seeing the world. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, I got very interested and realized that the web was where visualizations needed to go. Not all of them, but many. So obviously, that's where the people are. And so if you want to reach audiences and also avoid all these headaches with installation, et cetera, the web was looking really promising. Unfortunately, Java applets had while useful, had not proven to be painless. So that's why I ended up beginning to learn Flash. And then Flare was really just an extension of Prefuse, really trying to take the architectural ideas in Prefuse and see how they fit within the Flash world. And so along the way, a lot of things evolved, and that was just mostly through a conversation with things that the ActionScript language supported versus Java. Though along the way, I did get much more interested in richer forms of animation. And so I think that one of the major things that distinguishes Flare from Prefuse, other than just the platform, is that Flare has a much richer facilities for animation.
I always liked the architecture. I've been using it, I guess, for 2 years or so, really intensively, on every single project. And I was never impeded, it was, I think it's really well designed. So,
well, that's great to hear. And I have to say, for me, the biggest reward from building any of these frameworks is just seeing the amazing things that other folks come up with. I think the first project I remember seeing from you, Moritz, was the work you did on the eigenfactor.
That publication must be impact. 2 or 3 years ago, definitely.
That was a number of years ago. It was just beautifully done, and so it was. I count that among the projects that made me really happy, because I see this and I think to myself, I didn't know that you could do this with the tool. That's one of the really most rewarding aspects of building tools. Mm-hmm. It's just watching a community of folks do amazing work.
Jeff, that Moritz is a big fan of Flare, and he's still using it quite intensively.
I no longer use Flare, so I'm glad that you are.
Yeah. Now, the best part, I think, is that once you have your data structure defined, you can have so many views on the same data set, and very effortlessly. And I think it's still, also compared to the newer frameworks, this one is still the most flexible when it comes to this end. Once you have your data set up, what can I do with it? And, quickly prototyping approaches. And So I'm still using it. Yeah,
definitely.
Great. Yeah.
So I wrote Prefuse and Flare while a graduate student. And then I graduated and I came to Stanford, where I joined the faculty in 2009. And when I started is when I met Mike Bostock, who was a PhD student who had just recently joined the department. And so we started talking about possible visualization projects, and he took my course. And that's really within the courses where the ideas for ProtoViz first started, where Mike was looking at the approach we had taken with Prefuse and Flare, which in some ways is conceptually similar to other work that had been done in both in InfoViz and in the area of scientific visualization, which really kind of comes from a more mathematical mindset, where you think about a visualization as the result of this mathematical process, and so you want to subdivide that process into a set of operators that you might combine together in different ways. But it's really thinking from the top down, from a high point of abstraction, kind of what's the minimal amount of sub-abstractions can I do to create all these visualizations? And I think, that process works well, but one of the things that I found to be true with both Prefuse and Flare was that anytime that I've wanted to do something really unique, so not a cookie cutter type visualization, I'd have to create new operators, which basically meant I needed to be an expert in the toolkit architecture and have software engineering skills to basically add new building blocks into this set of components. And so one of the ideas that Mike had that got me very excited was, well, can we turn that around? And instead, from this high point of abstraction, thinking down to the result, think about the result first and foremost. So really kind of reason bottom up from the actual graphical marks that appear on the screen. And so that led to this notion of ProtoViz is basically a form of style sheets. So you think about cascading style sheets are a way to kind of, add colors and fonts and, line widths, et cetera, and all the elements in your web page. Can we do something similar where we style data? But to make that work, it can't just be constants like setting colors and spacings, but you have to have functions that map from the data and then to the visual elements, whether that's to drive color mappings or layouts, et cetera. And so that was the basic idea that drove ProtoViz, is again thinking bottom up about graphics. Data visualizations is just being statements that map data to graphical marks. And so we thought that that was nice for a number of reasons. One, it was kind of conceptually clean. It avoided this huge stack of abstractions that both Freffuse and Flair had. So that we hoped that even if there was a learning curve, once you got that initial learning curve, you'd pretty much know everything there is to know. It wouldn't be like what many people had experiences with Prefuse and Flair, where they'd get something working, and as soon as they wanted to make it more complicated, they have to pull back a layer of abstraction, and then pull back another layer of abstraction, mm-hmm, and then another, mm-hmm, and get deeper and deeper into the guts of the framework. And we wanted to avoid that, and sort of had a system that didn't require you to build, new components from scratch, but that within the design of the language itself, you could create just about anything you wanted to do. And so I don't know if we succeeded 100% on that goal, but that was the goal that drove us. Mm-hmm. And
I think ProtoVis is great for teaching visualization because it's so crystal clear in this process of we have some data. A part of that is mapped to dynamic properties. Other properties are static. Some properties might just depend on the index of something in a list. So mm-hmm. It's very clear in this regard, and all the rest is sort of left away somehow magically. And so I always found it great for teaching, just like how mm-hmm. does visualization work? What are visual variables? What are data types? How can mm-hmm. we mm-hmm. transform one into the other? This very simple idea.
But it turns out, that simple idea has, some powerful implications. So there's only so much you can do technically within a web browser. Mm-hmm. And so, but ProtoVis, while the primary implementation and release was in JavaScript, and that was the other thing that was different from Flare, of course, moving from Flash to HTML5, which I think was a, very good decision in hindsight. But one of the things that we were able to do is take the language model of ProtoVis and explore it in other programming languages as well. And these aren't implementations that were nearly as robust as the JavaScript ones, so we don't mm-hmm. really actively produce them, but it allows us to explore lots of interesting research questions. So the fact that, ProtoVis has this high-level declarative style of specification means we can do all sorts of optimization behind the scenes as well. Mm-hmm. So we're actually able to build a Java framework based on the ProtoVis language model that was 20 times more scalable than Prefuse. Mm-hmm. And that's because rather mm-hmm. than Prefuse exposing all the guts with ProtoVis, you have a clean language. And then much like, the databases take your SQL query and try and mm-hmm. execute mm-hmm. them optimally, we can do similar things for your visualization specification and try and make it much faster. Mm-hmm. And so as a different approach, a different language for talking about visualizations, it provided, a really fun space to explore with respect to systems research and InfoVis. And then, of course, at the end of this saga is D3, or data-driven documents. And this was born out of our experiences, over 2 years of ProtoVis use, and quite frankly, really exciting adoption by a number of folks of ProtoVis. We were just able to see some of the problems people had, both at a systems level in terms of performance issues, particularly with animation and interaction, but also the ways in which ProtoVis did or did not fit into people's existing workflows within the web browser. And so D3 made a number of decisions. One was it actually got rid of this simplified language of visual marks, and instead people bind data directly to elements within the web page, whether that's HTML tags or SVG tags. And this had a number of nice benefits. So one, if you're already familiar with these web standards, great, you can continue to leverage that expertise. It meant you could really easily do things like use CSS to style elements of your visualization. And it also greatly improved performance because there was no longer this middle layer of abstraction that the web browser had to translate between. So you could write a statement once, have it generate content on the web page with very little intermediary. And so being able to then just be able to select just subsets of your web page and manipulate and update just those made interactions and animations much faster too. Mm-hmm. So one way of thinking about it,
I think that was the biggest change, right? In ProtoVis, or everything had to be re-rendered all the time. Something changes, and D3 is much more a nested model where you can like just update one part. Or a selection of your tags.
So the basic notion of D3 is of a transform. So every statement is a document transformer, mm-hmm. not just a document generator, mm-hmm. like Protovist. So that was one big important change. But the way in which you describe those transformations is very similar to Protovist, at least conceptually. And so I often think of D3 as taking a lot of the ideas in Protovist, adding in some new ones, but really trying to make it work for the web environment in particular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, Protovist is kind of more kind of conceptually, I guess, self-contained, where D3 is really trying to just kind of, you know,
but
fit
I mean,
itself,
you're right.
Fit itself
I think
to the reality of web browsers.
Exists in an idealized world independent of any like web browsers. It's a mathematical thing, right? And
yeah,
D3
yeah.
is much more, again, like deep in the dirty, the what's really yeah. going on. And you get yeah. to work with the actual elements, you know, being used by your browser. And in the beginning, I remember that sort of, I was a bit scared of that because SVG is... Yeah, it's not yeah. ideally designed, and you have to deal with all these things, like how all the properties are called, and sometimes yeah. your X position is an X, sometimes it's a CX, and
yeah,
who
yeah,
knows
so
why, and it's like, who
we lost a, we yeah. lost a number of tidier elements in the
I
move from
so.
Protovist
yeah, yeah.
to D3, and in fact, I mean, I should share that, you know, part of the story here was that, you know, when Mike Bostock was coming up with the ideas for D3, you know, I was actually quite skeptical about a number of these things just because mm-hmm. I saw the trade-offs. But I think based on his interactions with Protovist users and also just his own, you know, quite formidable design sense, you know, Mike saw that, you know, this is what was necessary to really take this to do professional level, you know, as best as you can do in the browser type yeah, visualizations yeah. with the framework. And so I think there are many features of Protovist that we remember fondly. And mm-hmm. I think in other language environments would be great to bring back. But to really make this work in the web in a way that not only integrates with web standards, but also allows you to use any of your other web-based tools or frameworks that you're used to using, so really kind of be a good citizen in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, in the long run, so far I think time has shown that, you know, Mike's design decisions there were some good ones to make.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think success speaks for itself in this case. Yeah.
Yeah, I was personally surprised because I think D3 among the four is by far the most successful, right? And if you compare D3 to the others, I think that technically speaking, it's the one which has the highest learning curve, right? I mean, at the beginning when I saw it, I thought that it was too low level to be widely
mm-hmm.
adopted.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
in fact, what happened was exactly the opposite, that a lot of people adopted much more easily D3 than the
yeah.
others.
But you know what, Enrico? Yeah. Many people know jQuery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when you yeah. know jQuery, you sort of get the logic of chaining things and selecting and, you know, sub-selections, which might not be as natural to you, maybe if you come from a bigger programming language background
mm-hmm.
like Java
mm-hmm.
or
yeah.
so.
Mm-hmm.
Then you think like, what's this? Please.
So I have a couple thoughts on this because this is obviously something we've thought a lot about. And so one is the familiarity of a toolkit or language or its easiness to learn is often, you know, at least in part, very much a function of your familiarity with the programming language that it's written in. And obviously on all the runtime and the environment, et cetera, that comes along with that.
Yeah.
The other question I think is really important is there's a difference between time to master a tool and time necessary to put a tool into use. And so I feel
mm-hmm.
that for
mm-hmm.
folks, for example, familiar with Java or Flash, you know, for some of the basic solutions, you could take something from Prefuse and Flare, put it in, do some very simple modification very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And with D3, I think part of it is you could do that as well, I think, actually. But with D3, it might be a little bit longer. However, I think one of the things that is important to note is that I found that the time to mastery with D3 is actually shorter.
Mm-hmm.
With
mm-hmm.
Prefuse and Flare. So I think it has a learning curve that's very steep
mm-hmm.
initially,
mm-hmm.
but once you get on, you know, kind of up to that plateau,
then you are much,
you can do a lot.
Yeah,
I mean,
you
can really achieve a lot in terms of visualization, and you know, all, once you're up on that plateau, you know all of the primary concepts.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be confronted with, you know, a week later you realize there's a whole nother layer of things that you have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make further progress.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's been my experience and the experience of the students that I've been teaching in my visualization course at Stanford.
Yeah. How would you compare now these two approaches? So we have Prefuse and Flare,
mm-hmm.
which are these more, let's say, the typical Java-like libraries, like
yep.
trying to abstract a whole domain into its functional parts, and then your program is more or less a specialization of that general knowledge, if you want to put it that way. And then we have these more toolkit-like approaches, maybe, like D3 or Protowiz, where you create complexity by chaining or nesting simple operations.
So I think about it as Prefuse and Flare are examples of what I would call a component model architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a set of operators. It's basically a bunch of components, and you treat them, you know, metaphorically, we can treat them like Lego blocks, though they're somewhat sophisticated for a Lego block with lots of knobs and mm-hmm. buttons on the side.
Yeah.
But you can build, you know, the hope is that then you can chain these blocks together and build something wonderful. Whereas I think with Protoviz and D3 are more languages for visualization. And they might be as simple as languages, but they're basically providing a grammar for visualization.
Syntax and grammar, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and there's and there's, you know, there's been all sorts of really cool projects prior to this on grammars for visualization. So some listeners might be familiar with Leland Wilkinson's book, The Grammar of Graphics, which served as the inspiration for ggplot2, which is a grammar in the R statistical programming language. And for those of you familiar with Tableau, I mean, underneath Tableau, they call it VisQL, but it's also basically a generative grammar for data. Mm-hmm. Now, what's shared about all of those three things is those grammars are high level. And in fact, you make statements about data that get and visualizations, and they get translated into working visualizations. Mm-hmm. But those statements actually assume a lot. In some sense, they're ambiguous. Just like human language is ambiguous, they make a lot of design decisions for you.
Yeah.
And so the goal with Protoviz and D3 was to similarly provide a language or grammar-based approach, but do so at a lower level.
Mm-hmm.
Where
they, so you still have control.
Where that ambiguity is removed, mm-hmm. and you have, you know, complete control over the design. And, you know, the trade-off there is that means you have to specify more. It may be slower to develop certain things, you know, especially for very quick exploratory graphics.
Yeah.
Then the hope is then that, you know, a language like D3 provides an ideal environment where you might implement something like ggplot2 or something like Tableau for the web browser.
Yeah. Do you see any of these approaches being superior to the others? Or how would you, if you have a new project, let's say a practitioner, which type of tool would you use for which type of project?
It depends on the nature of the project. And if I have to integrate with a previous system, that would shape my system. But let's say, assuming I have a tabula rasa, so I have a clean slate, I actually prefer the Protoviz and D3 approach currently. There may be some novelty bias there, but it's also that I find that the functional language specification just seems to fit visualization really well.
Mm-hmm.
It just removes unnecessary abstractions. So from a clean theoretical sense, I like it, but more importantly, from a practical sense, I find that I can build things faster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if someone does not find that to be true for them for whatever reason and they prefer the other tool, then, you know, more power to them. I'm certainly not, as I mentioned before, I'm not dogmatic about this, but for my own personal tastes and experience, I like taking, you know, this sort of grammatical functional language approach to visualization design. It just seems, one, to fit the problem domain really well, and it also has this interesting property, at least the way we've implemented it, where unlike Prefuse and Flare, Protoviz and D3 are much more forgiving as to how you organize your data.
Mm-hmm.
So Prefuse and Flare are very specific data structures that you have to populate, and all the operators are designed to work with those things. Where with Protoviz and D3, as long as it's JSON objects or some JavaScript value provided as an array, it's then up to you to write the functions that work with that data effectively. And from some level, this is really an interesting debate, because you could look at it one way and say, well, this is silly. I mean, you're totally squandering reusability because this only works for this type of data.
You have to start
and you're like,
all
well,
over
I can't
again.
Reuse the chart. You know, this is silly. But the fact of the matter is, you know, and this comes back to the wrangling thing. It turns out manipulating your data is often much more painful than the minor modifications necessary to make these visualization specifications work.
Yeah.
And so, in practice, especially for custom jobs, you know, crafting the visualization specification to the structure of the data, you know, perhaps surprising to some, it certainly was surprising to me when we first realized it, was actually more efficient than trying to make all the data fit in one canonical format.
Yeah, it's interesting because somehow you have to start all over again. So in my Flare projects, I was reusing much more code across projects.
Mm-hmm.
And now D3 or so, I always start fresh, like blank slate. But then the starting is much faster, of course, because I don't have to think that much. I just start with one detail and bootstrap the whole thing from that. And it's much more fun. So it's not bad that you have to redo everything, let's say, for this new project again, because it's easy to do. And you're really customizing it then for this one thing. So, yeah. But it's interesting. I'm really interested to see how it will play out. If people get a bit frustrated with the sloppiness of JavaScript and try to, you know, get more library style and more enterprise style again, or if this functional approach will be in the end the dominant programming paradigm, could be as well. So,
well, JavaScript is only as sloppy as you make it.
Yeah, but
so far as you, as long as you also avoid all the things that should never be touched.
Yeah. Like testing for undefined values or something obscure like
refer,
that.
Refer any listeners to Doug Crockford's books and videos if they want to get up and running with JavaScript in the right way.
So, Jeff, what should people expect? Do you think we will stay with D3 for a long time, or is there anything new in the horizon and people should get ready to a new revolution again?
Well, that's actually a better question for Mike, who's really the Mike Bostock is really the powerhouse behind D3's design and development. I've just been happy to be along for the ride and to be able to contribute and work through these ideas with him.
But would you be comfortable with scrambling the old thing again, or?
I personally don't have the desire to do that. Yeah. I'm four frameworks in. I figured that's good. Maybe a third time was supposed to be the charm. But I think a Flare is really, is just, Prefuse, ported to Flare. So maybe third time is the charm here. But more to your question, what to expect? So there's a couple things. I think, so D3 is about creating a visualization. I think there are possibilities for higher level languages on top of D3. I already mentioned things like ggplot2 or systems like Tableau. I think those types of higher level analytic languages that you specify perhaps much less code but is more ambiguous at some level, and that generates visualizations that are implemented in D3 for you. Mm-hmm. I think that's very promising. Building on that further, I'm actually very curious, not in changing the underlying programming language, but how do we design interactive tools that allow people to create visualizations without having to explicitly write programs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what are ways that we can
through a user interface or?
Yeah, precisely. So imagine you have some maybe a little, borrow a little bit from Excel and spreadsheets, maybe borrow a bit from tools like Adobe Illustrator, as well as some new interactive paradigms. What are ways that through direct manipulation we can begin to specify visualizations? And that doesn't mean that you won't have any mathematics involved. Obviously, you might want to write formulas and data transformations and things like that. But there's probably ways of building ProtoViz and D3-like statements through interactive manipulation. And so that's something some of my students are interested in looking at. Mm-hmm. I think there's also, once you have a working visualization, I've been really inspired by the types of storytelling mechanisms that folks like the New York Times, Washington Post, Guardian have been pioneering. And so what are the right levels of abstraction and tools that allow people to author stories to share with others?
That's a great question too. Like how there's no authoring tool for these types of data driven stories at the moment, right?
Yeah. Yes, and so we actually have written a tool for doing this, which we currently call Ellipsis, as in dot dot dot, which is a very obscure reference to D3.
That goes around a few corners. Yeah.
This is developed by a student of mine named Arvind Sachinarayan, and so we're excited about that. But it's still in some early stages. We've been working with some journalists who've been helping us, understand its strengths and weaknesses and improve it. Cool. So hopefully it will appear in a future conference, as well as, of course, perhaps more importantly, be released as software for others to use once it evolves enough that it's ready for that.
Sounds great. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, these user interface driven tools, I mean, the holy grail there, of course, is to go beyond that cookie cutter stage where you just fill a template or a style
with
your data. And it's hard to move beyond that. So there have been a few approaches. I mean, Tableau, I'm a big fan of Tableau as well, but it's also good for only a couple of things, right? Not the whole, the full spectrum of what you want to do. Yeah. And
so I think of Tableau as two things. So one is it's an analysis tool.
Yeah.
So you can do really rapid exploratory analysis, and that's what it's designed for.
Yeah. Yeah.
For putting on a design hat for a moment, I also think of it as a prototyping tool. It can't express all of the visualizations, you know, that I would want to do, you know, by any means, but it can allow me to explore the space and that I refine my ideas so that before I move to code, I end up having a much clearer ideas of what types of visual forms will work and which probably won't.
Yeah.
And so I think this is an enabler.
This is pretty much the way you work, Moritz, right? You mentioned many times to me that you start from Tableau, right?
Mm-hmm. But I don't really prototype visual ideas in Tableau because for that it's too limited, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I also use it in this very early stage of getting a sense of the texture of the data, of the distributions of the data, of the potential combinations of attributes, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, just to see, okay, how sparse does it become when I cross authors and countries, you know, and stuff like that.
And that's primarily what I mean, though. I think for some simpler instances, you can get some ideas into visuals as well.
Yeah, but I remember, to get a scent of where the interesting things might lie and then...
So I remember I was lucky enough a number of years ago, I spent a summer working with Martin Wattenberg. And one of the things that I always really admired about his work, among the many things I admire, is that he just seemed to have this great knack for giving a massive data set, picking the 2 to 3 variables that just told the richest story.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to take a very complex data set and make sacrifices, I'm not going to be able to communicate everything. Which subset do I keep to really create a compelling experience? And he just seemed to be able to nail that every time. Mm-hmm. And so I try to weekly approximate that in whatever way I can by going through with Tableau first and finding out where the stories are and the data before I commit too heavily to any one particular implementation effort.
Yeah, I personally believe this is one of the most important skills for a visualization designer. I think I mentioned that several times in the podcast as well. And paradoxically, it's not about visualization. I mean, the most important thing is what features you choose to visualize, right?
Yes.
And it's hard. It's really hard because you don't want to get rid of stuff, at least at the beginning, but you have to go through this painful process where you have to admit...
You have to kill your darlings.
You have to kill... Yeah, exactly. So maybe we want to move on to the next topic I have on my list. Since you are here and you are a very well-known researcher in the area of visualization, I want to take this opportunity to ask you something about the relationship between research, industry, designers, and so on. And I have to thank Benjamin Widerker, who is a friend of us, who sent a lot of questions about this specific topic. I want to read you out loud maybe a couple from him. They are somewhat similar, just to introduce the topic. He asked something like how does he close the gap between practice and research, or scientific papers have long been the medium of discourse in the scientific community. Unfortunately, designers are not trained or used to writing papers, and thus their work is often not reflected in the scientific community. How could this gap be bridged? Should it? And so on. I think this whole set of questions are really interesting. Maybe you want to comment on that, Jeff.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that's really fun is that we're in an exciting time where I think the opportunity for research, industry, design, et cetera, to be in conversation with each other has almost never been richer.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's always, one always gets proven wrong when making statements like that, but I'll run with it for the time being. but in any case, so how do I close the gap between practice and research? Well, I release a lot of software, and my students release a lot of software, and so that's probably been how we've had the most interaction with practice, is that we build tools that many practitioners use. And so I'm a strong believer in open source software and making tools available. I'm not a zealot in terms of that, but I think it's just a really important way to realize the practical impacts of research.
Yeah, but I think that's a structural issue, because I can totally see you're doing that, and that's so great. But the problem is somehow you don't get to write a paper on how you fixed a few bugs that your practitioners were asking for, you know?
Yeah, so no,
I think this is for
a PhD
student, it's a problem, isn't it? I mean, they should focus on their papers and all these practical issues.
Yeah. I think that that's a concern, and mm-hmm. it has to be, you know, addressed intelligently. And I'll give you just a quick anecdote, one example. When I was initially working on Prefuse, you know, this is many years ago now, I was very active on the support forums.
Yeah.
And I tried to answer questions as quickly as I could. And I think early on that was important. But as you might imagine, as you're alluding to, this gets exhausting.
Sure.
And at one point, I'm just too tired. I'm just like, I can't do this right now. And so I stopped answering, you know, not entirely, a video just for like a day or two. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, creating that space allowed other people to step up and start asking the question. I realized, like, how long have I been doing all this work unnecessarily? And also, you know, curtailing the opportunity for others to get visibility and take on leadership roles in the community. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I don't think I ever did a particularly wonderful job at cultivating, you know, a sustainable open source community around those tools. But certainly there's ways that you can do that. And I think we've been more successful with ProtoViz and D3 in that we do have lots of contributors who are helping fix those bugs. But at the same time, it's also, you know, Mike spends a ton of time on that.
It's a big
commitment. And so you just have to throttle
really
your commitment.
Built around him,
at the end of the day, you have to make an informed decision. If your primary goal is going to be research, you just have to scope it and say it's so that you can release software and just give it a disclaimer. But by making it open source, if there are other people who can use it and contribute back, you know, it may improve slowly, maybe just in a couple fits and starts, or with enough shepherding, maybe have a long-term life. These are all possible outcomes. Mm-hmm. But getting real-world feedback and seeing people use your software, one is, I think, a very valuable reward in its own right. But even if you're going to be myopically focused on research, what people do with the tool fuels research ideas. Even if it's not around that specific project, mm-hmm. it will fuel an idea for a new project.
Mm-hmm.
You'll just see how people stumble on something. You're like, oh, wait, well, that's an interesting problem. Like, why do people have such a hard time coming up with a good color palette? That might not be a Prefuse problem, but maybe, maybe it gives you some insights on how to better approach, you know, tools for crafting, you know, color mappings, etc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important. I think there's also another side to this that I want to jump to because I think it's also important. I think researchers have a lot to learn from practitioners.
I agree.
In my personal experience, I mentioned earlier, what blew me away is what journalists, artists, and others have been doing with storytelling mechanisms. Mm-hmm. around visualizations. And so a student who had worked with me here at Stanford, Eddie Sagel, wrote a paper with me where he just looked at what folks at the New York Times and other outfits are doing and then try and organize that and look for recurring design patterns.
Uh-huh.
And so in this way, people are exploring this space. And so, you know, one way that I think academics might help is that we might have the time and maybe, you know, certainly we don't have the deadlines of a newsroom, which helps, but maybe also kind of a different perspective that might allow us to think about what practitioners are doing and engage in a discussion that we both can benefit from. And I really hope, and I know others are working on this, that we have a much higher representation of folks in the analytics industry and also, you know, visualization designers coming to our academic conferences and participating in those conversations. I know we're trying to create, you know, new attractive venues for folks to come, but we still have a long way to go. And so we really love to get feedback from folks in the community of practitioners on how to better forge connections between these groups.
I think that's a key point, trying to have events where academics and practitioners can meet and discuss and show each other what they are doing. I think that we don't have that right now, and I think we are moving some initial steps in this direction, and for instance in the BizWeek conference this year for mm-hmm. the first time, but we have to do much, much more, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I see more and more of these activities.
And at the same time,
so,
there are events that are more centered around design and or industry, and normally academics don't participate to this kind of events. Mm-hmm. So it's both ways, right?
Sure, absolutely. No. Okay. It's just different. Yeah, it's different types of scenes, different types of, let's say, day-to-day work, and but both could definitely profit a lot from more dialogue, that's for
but
sure.
But it's true. I mean, yeah. I want to stress again what Jeff said. I mean, me being myself more an academic kind of person and going to several conferences every year, I'm always surprised. I mean, now maybe I'm no longer surprised, but I used to be very much very surprised to see how many beautiful and complex things skilled designers can do. And I've never seen mm-hmm. such a good quality in any of the visualization conferences I attended. This is part of the reason why I started blogging and participating to this whole thing. Yeah. Because I really thought about, man, we can learn something here. At the same time, I think we can teach a lot, but we can also learn a lot. I mean,
absolutely.
And I totally believe in this kind of, communication that we need to have and to put in place. Yeah, but I wanted to ask to Jeff something related but different. I am sure you are aware of the endless debate on the web between people who are more orthodox, people like us who come from academia. I've been in several comments in my blog post. I had people saying, oh, you are an orthodox coming from academia and just saying that you have used color and length for this and that and never bend the rules. And then you have these overly creative designers who come up with stuff that you cannot even read. And then we had several times. I'm sure you know things about Stephen Few publishing this quite harsh blog post about, I don't know, fancy designer and stuff that is not really proper. David what's your take on that?
Yeah, the McCandless debate. Yeah. What was interesting about that, and I was surprised I didn't get more take, was that some of the folks in the design community, who I respect to no end, were quite merciless on that particular McCandless design team. I think at the end of the day, this is, everyone loves a good drama. And it's fun, I think. But I don't think anyone disagrees that both function and aesthetics are important.
I think to
say otherwise is a straw man. That's, I think, easily dismissed. And certainly that's Stephen Few's take, and that's everyone else's take. But people have very different points of emphasis. And I think where those different points of emphasis often emerge is because people are trying to achieve different goals with visualization. And so if one jumps into a debate without first having common ground as to, given a particular visualization design effort, what are we trying to achieve? And I know that, I've had long conversations with Stephen about some of these issues. And I know he's, talked to folks in the area of business intelligence where his understanding is that the primary goal is to understand the data in a way that reflects what's really in the data and informs a certain type of decision making that avoids people making mistakes that might, cost lives or lose money.
But that's not always the case, right? When
that's your framework, obviously things that exaggerate or perhaps lead to slight or sometimes gross misinterpretation of the data can be seen as a big problem. And so he's very loud because he's targeted towards that specific community where he sees if wrong ideas sink in, then it can do a lot of damage. Some people might be debating, it might be coming from a very different perspective and trying to design in a very different environment where, I certainly think there's value in having things be not just, aesthetic, but, evocative, one, because you're trying to communicate, so you're evoking the concepts that you care about, that's an important design attribute, but maybe also to get people's attention. What if this is an important issue? What is it something that you will be able to pull a reader in and then hopefully communicate, other information effectively to them to help them make a decision? And so I think, I've also seen debates of this on other blogs as well. You can see statisticians talk about this. I don't know if you follow Andrew Gelman's blog.
Yeah, I do.
But these issues come up as well, where I just see kind of a rampant misunderstanding of what InfoViz is, just because everyone seems to have a different definition. And so it's not that any single definition is wrong, but it's certainly, they're different. There's different goals. And I think being very clear about what is a successful outcome for a visualization? What are you trying to achieve? And then picking the methods, the visual encodings, the appropriate level of rigor, et cetera, to achieve those goals is important.
And what I'm really interested in is So at the moment, we're sort of jumping a bit between these sort of different purposes, like exploratory purposes or more explanatory, simpler visualizations, complex visualizations. I think everybody's still figuring it out. And so, for instance, the thing I've been doing for a few years is this really highly customized visualization for one data set that is really like high end, but only for this one purpose. Or maybe Ben Fry, Martin Wattenberg, you know, these types of the style of working. So on the one hand, very exploratory, but at the same time, very much focused on one issue. Do you think these things will be around in 5 years still, or will we move towards more, let's say, more different types of approaches?
Well, I don't know what to contrast it to. I hope it is there 5 years from now. And in fact, probably more developed. I think one area that I think is exciting, I think one way, maybe if you don't mind me twisting the question a bit, is to say, well, where will these types of designs and technologies show up where maybe they're not showing up now? And so right now you have, you know, maybe for activism or for corporate sponsorship or for any number of reasons, you know, or journalism, you're seeing some interesting interactives primarily on the web. And you know, there's, you know, as an educator, and also a science fiction fan, I've always been really interested in, you know, what's the textbook of the future? And I'm not alone in this. For example, my colleague Pat Hanrahan here at Stanford has a research project around this. But how do these types of interactivity and engagement around these very singular important issues, whether that's, you know, global development trends or that's, you know, the fundamentals of modern physics, we should have these sort of interactive experiences to be able to understand them, interrogate them, understand what it means to make different modeling assumptions, et cetera. And so I like to see those types of custom designs applied in education. I think that would be really exciting.
Do you refer to stuff like, do you know these explorable explanations from Brett Victor? Victor?
Yes, yeah. Yes. That's one of the examples I have.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating,
so thanks for bringing that
fascinating
up.
Direction of development. Yeah, and I think there is a place for visualization there, definitely. Okay, and I have another bunch of questions about current developments in visualization. And do you have an idea? I got some questions regarding why do you think visualization is so interesting now? Why? I mean, we all agree that it exploded during the last, I would say, 1 year or so. Why now? What is happening? Do you have any idea about that?
Sure. I don't think it's particularly insightful. It's just if you track a bunch of trends, they all intersect right around now. And so what do those trends include? So not obviously data's been growing for a long time, but it's not only is it just growing, the accessibility of data and kind of the diversity of people interacting with data is at a kind of an interesting spot. And meanwhile, the abilities of web browsers to you know provide a visualization, you know, hit the right spot. And so I don't think it's actually an issue of tools. I think it's an issue of you know both the audience for data and the technology in terms of the browsers, which is the main vehicle for communicating stuff, are in the right place. And so once you have that, people are going to build the tools to realize on that possibility.
But at the same time,
we have lots of data. We have to do something with it. And our mainstream media outlets in the forms of web browsers are now sophisticated enough to enable us to present that data in new ways. Yeah. And so I don't think it's particularly surprising that a large variety of folks are taking advantage of that.
But I'm personally fascinated by the fact that, I don't know, me coming from academia, if we take the whole area of data analysis, we have several branches that historically have been dealing with data, like databases or data mining, stuff like that, which historically are much bigger than InfoVis or visualization in general, right? But if you look at the web and how people perceive data analysis at large, the layman, visualization is much more successful and powerful in a way, right? I don't know if you agree with me, but if you look,
I think those technologies enable each other. So I think you have a kind of a multiplication effect amongst them. So.
Yeah.
I'd hate to do visualization in a world without databases. Or maybe I'd love it because then I could invent databases. That would be great.
Sure. Yeah, but I think there's a lot to it. And I mean, there's two ways of dealing with this big data issues. Is the one is really good algorithms and really good black boxes, like, you know, Google, where you just type in one word and the algorithm finds the best match. Or you do something where you empower people actually to find themselves what they're looking for, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a lot of where a lot of the attraction of visualization is coming from, that it sort of, it empowers us again and doesn't like give us this feeling of we can't do anything about this whole big thing.
Well, the thing I've always loved about visualization is that, you know, feel free to disagree, but I think fundamentally visualization is not a technology, that it's about answers. It's about questions.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I totally agree.
And so if I can go to Google and type something in and get the answer I'm looking for, that's great.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's something. But it's, okay, I ask a question, I see, you know, some kind of answer or some kind of response in terms of the data and a visualization, but I see it in the context of everything else. I see the things that I didn't expect, and it causes me to form new questions and new hypotheses, and it's that sort of contextualized exploration of data that allows me to ask smarter questions, which mm-hmm. is for me always been what has been so attractive about visualization.
Yeah,
but at the same time, I think that's really, I fully agree with you, Jeff, but at the same time, I think this requires a whole kind of mind shift in a whole set of different branches. For instance, I think in science, lots of scientists are more used to start from an hypothesis and then searching for the data to check
to support
whether
the hypothesis.
Either support or reject this hypothesis,
exactly.
Right? And recently I started...
I think that's the way we write about science. I'm not convinced. I mean, all experiences under the sun have probably been had here. But I think in many cases there are questions. You have a hunch. So you get some data to see, is this hunch worth following further? And then it turns out your hunch was wrong, but another hunch that's slightly related to it does have promise, and you follow that. And then when you write the paper, you talk about, oh, you know, this hunch was, you know, we had this, and we ran this study, and we got this result. And you don't write about all the trail of dead ideas that got you there. Mm-hmm. And you don't even talk about the set of pilot studies often or other kind of smaller prototypical activities that allowed you to gauge the successfulness of that. And so I think there's an interesting separation to be made between the process of science and the rhetoric of science.
I
both exert, you know, influence.
Sure.
Okay, and so let's talk briefly about the future of visualization. So where do you think we are going?
I don't think we're leaving the web.
You think this internet thing is gonna stay?
I think the internet thing's working out pretty well. I hope it continues to do so. Certainly, I think there's an interesting point now where I would love to be able to design in something similar to like the web browser type environment and have it work on a variety of devices. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, you can get a D3 visualization working on the iPad, and that's great, but it's very difficult to make it feel as smooth as a native app.
Sure.
So certainly, I think all that you know, new technologies and new interfaces will certainly play a role. There'll probably, for different input modalities, you might have to, you know, shift how we do things. I don't see these as big challenges. I'm not even, you know, I'd like there to be cool research questions there, but I actually haven't been able to convince myself that there are. I think there's a really important work for practitioners to do, certainly. Mm-hmm. Maybe interesting research questions as well that hopefully others will figure out. Where is Viz going? Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think understanding the life cycle of data analysis, this notion of interactive data analysis I brought up earlier, is, I think, I don't mean to be self-serving, but since I'm, you know, putting a lot of my effort into that, you know, it's because I think that's where Viz should go. Really understanding, you know, and that means, you know, one thing that's been really fun for me being within a computer science department is looking for the ways visualization can fruitfully dovetail with other sub-disciplines within computer science. So how does combining visualization with statistical modeling help us understand those models better, maybe arrive at a good model more quickly, or combining it with database techniques allow us to clean data and get it ready for analysis more quickly? I think there's lots of interesting challenges along those lines. More broadly, I think, you know, I guess what for lack of a better term, I'll call the consumerization of visualization, or mm-hmm, you know, within the field, what we've called visualization for the masses or casual infoviz. Mm-hmm. I think that's just going to become more and more important. We're already seeing it in journalism. I think, you know, that the types of data resources that everyday people have, you know, sorry, what people have to work with in their everyday lives, whether it's just their music collections or their movie collections, or as we begin to track more and more of our own health data and stuff, just we're going to have so much data about ourselves, our friends, our families, you know, our vital statistics, et cetera. So I think that means many more consumer-oriented visualization displays. But I think to be really empowering, it also requires better and better design tools that allow people to manipulate and explore their data in ways that, you know, another designer may have never envisioned. Mm-hmm. And so whether that's through, you know, I don't know what the right level of sophistication of those tools should be for different audiences, but certainly ways that allow people to express creative visualizations with a minimum of programming seems like a good step to take in that direction.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting because, I mean, one thing I'm sort of wondering about is that there is no integration of visualization on maybe on operating system level yet or into big web products. So neither Google nor Facebook nor macOS X, for that matter, have a visualization component, you know? So do you think this is just, it takes a while still, so we are so far ahead sort of that the sort of the mainstream software market has to catch up? Or is there a fundamental sort of...
I'm not convinced it needs a viz component. That's an interesting idea. I don't mean to discredit it. I think that's worth exploring. I would like them to have a data component that is easy to access. I think that the web browser, you know, while it could be even better, is... in many intents and purposes, a visualization framework now. And so it's really about the fluidity of data. And
you want to be able to grab that data and transform it yourself and put it somewhere else and compare it to other data and so on. Yeah, that's an
excellent
point.
And so if you think of the operating system as more kind of a services model level, then great, as long as I can, you know, open a socket and get data into my web browser. Yeah. And then hopefully then also be able to talk back to other systems. So I think that's one other thing too that we all realize but don't always talk about as much, which is visualizations obviously very powerful output devices for people to make sense of data, but they can be incredibly powerful contextualized input devices too. So thinking about, you know, how we use visualizations to gather data is actually kind of interesting as well, both for people but also actually for scientists. We've designed tools like that for data entry, et cetera.
Yeah, often it's still seen as a viewing device, right? And not as an action device. And I also believe this, especially with new touch interfaces and so on, a big potential for like making expressive tools for people as well. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think one other thing I just want to answer your finish answering your question, Enrico, about where viz is going. One thing I haven't touched on yet is kind of the more theoretical side of information visualization. And so, though I haven't talked about them much today, a number of the projects in our group are focused on issues of perception and cognition. How do we study that? How can we build better models of, you know, what happens when you look at a visualization? What sort of guidelines can we provide that help aid visualization design? I think it's important. I don't want to say we want to automate it completely. We don't want to create, you know, rules, you know, of the sense that you must follow these rules. But I do think understanding the nature of perception and cognition can help us gain guidance to really, you know, make reasoned trade-offs and choices as we explore different design ideas. And so I think it's a very important area for visualization research, and also one where I think will continue to be a rich and at sometimes contentious conversation between research and design communities.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I personally believe that it's really surprising how visualization has been developed in academia, because we had the fathers of visualization who spent quite a lot of time and thoughts thinking about what's the best, the most basic theoretical things, especially connected to perception. And then we had this long time where we basically have been developing tools after tools and techniques and stuff like that. And I think only recently we started thinking about going back to the basics and really thinking about what's the connection between I don't know, the basic principles of visualizations and how they connect with perception and stuff like that. And I think we still don't have enough of that, because if when you look into the basic guidelines we have and the basic understanding of human perception we have, it's a very rough set of tools, in my opinion. I mean, yes. It's very solid, but it's at the same time, I think it's limited. There is a lot to explore and understand there.
Oh, there's just so many questions to ask, and we're still trying to get the right kind of research instruments in place. So I think, for example, crowdsourcing is one really amazing and powerful instrument. You know, you can run studies at a speed and a cost and with a diversity of participants that in the past would be, you know, hard to fathom.
Yeah, or once you have a certain audience, you can do also A/B testing, like present two alternatives to one part of your audience and another alternative to another part, and just see what happens, you know, how that changes their behavior. And this can be very powerful. Yeah.
But I think about all the cool visualizations that are being put out there, and you know, all the work, you know, from journalistic shops, you know, all of that usage data is results of basically, you know, a live experiment.
Yeah,
and there may not have been, like, you know, variables manipulated, so it might be hard to draw contrast. But you know, to do A/B testing, as you describe, be very interesting. To be able to maybe in the future get things like eye tracking data or know where people were spending their time looking and what the perceptual effects of different elements were, but also to try and get at things that aren't just, you know, how long did I spend on the site, or you know, how accurately did I compare one bar in a bar chart to another bar, but really if there's ways to get a sense of what people are learning, busy figuring out, you know, what are the right types of questions to ask participants? What are the types of measurements? We still have a lot to learn, and a lot to learn from other disciplines, including psychology, about how to do this well. But I think, you know, especially as we start looking at larger audiences who aren't just analysts, it's really important.
Yeah, and we are still in a very preliminary phase where we are trying to develop the tools that will help us to better understand visualization. So even the tool set is not defined yet. Right? I think this is what you meant, what you wanted to say, Jeff. I mean, this, for instance,
we have tools, we need more.
Yeah, we need more. Sure. Okay, I think we can almost stop it here. I wanted to mention something before finishing. I cannot remember. Jeff, I wanted to ask you, we have lots of listeners who are people who, I would say, visualization novices, they get excited about visualization and they really don't know where to start from. You are a professor. I'm sure you are in contact with many students who just start understanding what visualization is, and maybe they get excited about it. So do you have any suggestion to people who get excited about this, but they don't really know where to start from? And even if they want to go through, I don't know, some academic curriculum or stuff like that, what are the options for, and what do you suggest for novices?
Well, I think first and foremost, what I tell people to do, if you're interested in visualizations, then make visualizations.
Yeah,
absolutely. And hopefully in a way that you can also get feedback from people. That's an important part of the learning. But so what I say, well, people say, I'm interested in visualization. And I say, well, great, what data?
What data
have you scratching your head? You know, what's the question that you're dying to know the answer to? And then and then sometimes people, you know, they go, no, I just liked pretty pictures. And I'm like, okay, that's great, but you might want to, you know, I don't know if you want to take my class. but like, you know, what is it you want to learn? Like, what's something that you're just passionate about or exciting? Or what's something that you saw that you learned something new? Like, yeah, I think it's, for me, a lot of the visualization is about the thrill of discovery and the thrill of learning. And this is true of both exploratory and also communicative stuff. Like, what I love communicative visualizations, because they teach me something I didn't know, or they give me a perspective on an issue that I didn't have before. And so it's finding interesting data sets, or finding a data set that you already saw visualized and you thought was interesting. Well, how would you redesign it? That's a great way to start. Someone already found an interesting story. Tell that same story in a different way. Or can you tell a different story with that same data? And you don't have to have a deep technical skill to start here. I mean, you can draw it by hand if the data set's small enough, or you can manipulate it in Excel and at least start playing with it there. You can use tools like Tableau, Many Eyes, and a number of other free visualization tools, and then eventually maybe start designing your own, whether you want to use Protoviz and D3 or use processing or whatever framework you're excited about. I think practice of building visualization is the most important. And then once you start to get that going, you'll want to couple that with some of the more theoretical and conceptual aspects of the field. And for that, I recommend looking at different academic curricula. I think are still websites for classes on the web are probably still the best place to look for that.
Yeah. This reminded me that several people asked whether you will ever give a course, an InfoVis course on Coursera or something similar.
You know, I don't have any current plans to, but I would love to do that eventually. I think I'm a little shy.
I would totally
because
take
I think
it. Yeah.
because I think there's like there's a copyright nightmare in the making to put that online. But assuming we can get past that, I would love to do that. And so I can't make any guarantees as to when that might happen, but it's certainly something I would be very excited to do.
Great. So, and before finishing, I would love to mention that you told me when you visited Constance that you are going to open a startup or opened already a startup. Do you want to tell us something about it? What is it about?
Sure. So we are nominally in stealth mode, so I won't say too much, but the name of our company.
But you know, here we need some scoop here, me and Moritz.
Yeah, okay, but no, it's not secret either. I know the name of our company is Trifacta. And it's the notion is we had this idea of an analytic trifecta. That's people, data, and computation. And so we basically want to build tools to make those three things work together more smoothly. Mm-hmm. And this is with my co-founders, Joe Hellerstein from Berkeley and Sean Kendall from Stanford.
Okay.
And so we're really interested in these aspects of manipulating data, you know, sort of data wrangling we talked about earlier, as well as other parts of the process. And the main goal is to be able to build tools that make working with data a really interactive experience as opposed to just, you know, writing code in an editor. And but not only interactive, but the ability to really work with data at large scales. And so that's the teaser I'll give you for now. Yeah. Keep your eyes peeled.
Great.
We'll have more, hopefully, coming out in the coming months.
So do you plan to develop any tools that will be available on the web and people will be able to play with?
We'll see.
Great. Okay. I don't know, Moritz. Do you want to ask something else, or we can?
Oh, I'm happy. It's been a great.
It's been a great conversation.
So, of course, we
could continue for another
forever. No problem, yeah.
Jeff, thanks a lot. It was great having you here. It's fantastic. I think it was a really nice episode.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a blast talking with you both.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Very cool.
Thanks a lot. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Have fun. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.